We can open to the fifth chapter of the book of Matthew. Everybody open up their Bibles and look at what will be probably have to be split up in two. And probably all of these will have to end up being split up individually. Again, I thought I would be able to cover more ground. But as we kind of start pulling some of these things out, there's just a lot of teaching that needs to be done. And so we definitely don't want to sacrifice that. So we finished last week or 2 weeks ago looking at verses 13 through 19 and talking about Jesus' fulfillment of the law. He's not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it, to fill it fully. Okay, to fully fill out. Okay, say that five times fast. Fully fill out everything that was to do with the law. So we kind of talked about how with the implications that the law had, people had lost sight of that. Okay. So what had happened was is that over, you know, thousands of years of teaching, of getting further and further away from the intentions of what God had with the law, you had something that was a shell of what it was supposed to be. God would make mention of this in prophecies that he would give to the Israelites as they were going out. Okay, so in Micah and Habakkuk and places like that, he would make mention of the fact that you had forgotten what the true meaning of the law was. That I was not satisfied or desired sacrifices of blood of goats and bulls and animals, but I desired mercy. Okay. I desired truth. I desired love. He will talk to the Pharisees. Christ will talk to the Pharisees and other Jewish leaders and say that you are heavy in tithing of mint and cumin and all these other little minute additions to the law. He says, but you have forgotten the weightier matters of the law, like to do mercy and justice. And so he says that you have missed what the original intention was. Okay, he says, so I have not come to destroy it. I have come to fulfill it, to fill it out fully, to show you what the true embodiment of the law was. Okay, and we discussed this briefly last time, that then he's going to go on for about a chapter and a half talking about multiple different aspects of the law that have been, I'm not going to say changed, they have been what I would say whittled down, okay? So it has been classified in a very narrow application, okay? The narrowest application you could possibly come up with. And what happens with that is that the more narrow you get, the less implications it has, okay? So we talk about this sometimes with the parable of the Good Samaritan, you know, who is my neighbor? Narrow it down for me. Let me get a certain subset of people that I can then say, well, then I have loved my neighbor, okay? And the more narrow, the better, because if I can narrow it down just to my immediate neighbor, okay, the person next door to me and not the person two houses down to me, well, that is one person that I have to meet on that mark, okay? Well, that's easy, you know, hopefully we can do that, especially if they're a good neighbor. Well, then I have loved my neighbor, you know, I carried them some sugar when they needed it, or I didn't, you know, mow over their side of the lawn, whatever it may be. I took their trash down, you know, at the end of their driveway for them, so now I have loved my neighbor, and now I can check that off and say I did that, okay? So that's a very narrow description. And what Christ ended up doing was saying, no, let me tell you who your neighbor is. And then gave a story of people who were in no way geographically located near one another. Okay. In fact, they weren't even culturally near one another. They weren't even familially near one another. These were strangers walking on the road. And he says, that's your neighbor. The one that's in the ditch that needs help. The one that culturally is not on your side of things. The one ethnically is not in your grouping. Okay? It says, but it was a man who was in need, and that's your neighbor. So he narrows it. He takes the narrowed view that they had come up with to try to fulfill the law and mark off their ticks on their chart. And he says, no, this is it. It's a big, beautiful, broad, all-encompassing view of who our neighbor is, and we're to love them. So here he says, I'm going to fully fill out this view for you. Okay? And I use the example of whenever you maybe have a pair of pants and you go to Africa and you lose some weight and then you feel a little bit loose in those pants, right? And you can put those pants on and you can draw that old belt around and feel really good about yourself. And then you go about 6 months down the road and you get back on some good American food and all of a sudden you have fully filled out those pants again, okay? And there's no more room and you can actually wear them without a belt. That would be a fully filled pair of pants, correct? All right, so that's what Christ did with the law. He filled it out, okay, because they had enjoyed their very narrow purview of what it was, okay? So he also used the example of thinking about like that big bag, industrial-sized bag of potato chips that you get, okay? And you get this like 10-gallon bag and you're like, oh, 10 gallons of Doritos Cool Mint. You know, you could just live off of that, all right? And you open the bag up, and much to your chagrin, half of it is air, okay? So you didn't get 10 pounds of chips, okay? Which is very, very disappointing, okay? Because you open that up thinking, I'm going to have a feast, and it turns out it's half empty. Well, you know, they filled it with air and all, and so you get this industrial bag, but you really didn't get 10 pounds of chips like you wanted. It was not fully filled, was it? So Christ says, I'm going to show you what fulfillment of the law is. And it wasn't just keeping it legalistically. It was filling out the desired intentions of it. Okay, so we start to see this as he goes from verse 20 to 26. And like I said, if you have one of the study type Bibles or just the Bibles that like to give center column references and headings, you'll have headings like murder or anger or adultery or lust or divorce and oaths and things like that. So here we look from 20 to 26, and basically he's talking about anger is what he's going to be dealing with. Starting in verse 20, he says, "For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Rakah, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way. First be reconciled and offer thy gift. First be reconciled to thy brother and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge and the judge deliver thee to the officer and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the othermost farthing." So in this section of scripture, he's teaching about anger and the consequences of anger and tying it to a law that was in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. Okay. And he said, thou hast heard it said, and you'll see this over and over again. Ye have heard it said, ye have heard it said again. Ye have heard it said. And what he is talking about is you have heard over the last couple of thousand years what thou shalt not kill means. And we're going to look into that a little bit this morning or this afternoon, that there is teachings that have gone on about this law for many, 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 many years. And again, we talked about they narrowed down the view of what it was to apply to. Okay, and this falls in books of the Hebrew writings like the Talmud. You know, we've briefly discussed that as we've talked through Wednesday night on different philosophies and things that the Hebrews rely on a couple of sets of scriptures. One of them would be the Torah, which includes the first five books, the Pentateuch, as they would call it, the first five books of Moses. And then you have the Psalms and the Proverbs, and you have the prophets and things like that that are included with that. Well, there's an additional set of writings that is the kind of commentary and discussion-wise based on the law of the Hebrew leaders. So you'd have a rabbi, and they would go up and say, well, rabbi, what is permissive on the Sabbath day? What is work and what is not work? And then they would have a discussion about it. And some of the things that kind of gain traction would get written. I know this is a Hebrew scholar would probably crucify me for this, but it's a very it's a very kind of rolling commentary that the Talmud encompassed many questions that maybe the law didn't answer, okay? So is it okay to walk a certain amount of distance from your house on the Sabbath day? Is it okay to, you know, all this stuff? This is what Jesus got into when he was talking to the Pharisees, you know, is it lawful to heal a man on the Sabbath day? Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath day? Well, those are questions that would have been involved in the Talmud, okay? And so they have discussions about this law, thou shalt not kill, and what it all encompasses. And so we will look at some of that as well as we'll go through all of these. But I do want you to look kind of at the groupings, okay? And we'll try to do kind of two at a time, but it may not always work. Here you have these two groupings here. One is murder or anger, coupled with adultery or lust, okay? Adultery, murder, anger, lust. The second is divorce and oaths. Well, that goes together, doesn't it? Retaliation versus love. Almsgiving and prayer and fasting. I mean, all these things, they kind of tie together. Wealth and judging. And all this ties together in base principles like we were talking about. What does it mean to follow Jesus Christ? What did Jesus say it meant to follow him? So as we look at murder and adultery, or we look at anger and lust, which is really what the base of it is, you think about anger and lust and realize that, you know, anger and lust are like the two first kind of original sins, okay? You go back to the Garden of Eden, and you go back to the very first humans. So Adam, Eve, Cain, Abel. You have lust, and you have anger. Going that back that far. That's to the beginning days of all of us. You look in the third chapter of the book of Genesis, and where the serpent is beguiling Eve. And as he is beguiling Eve, he says that Eve then turned around. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired. Okay. A tree to be desired. We're looking at something. We see it's pleasant with our eyes. And it's desirous. That's when she entered into the transgression. That desiring, that word, that's a Hebrew word for lust. Okay? So one of the original sins that we see in the Bible is a lusting. That's where it came from. Lusting after this fruit, looking at it and say, oh, and look how good it looks, and oh, how desirous it is, and ultimately led to the transgression. You have with Cain and Abel, and I don't think this is very hard to figure out, is it? What happened with Cain and Abel? They offered sacrifices. God didn't accept Cain's sacrifice. God was not pleased with Cain's sacrifice. Cain was unhappy about that turn of events. In fact, it says he was wroth with his brother Abel, or angry with his brother Abel. And where did that lead to? Murder. So these two first principles he talks about are like the two first sins that we see in the Bible. Kind of gives you this kind of history of the fact that these things are still around today very much, still bothering us today very much. They were all the way back in the very beginning. Kind of a very foundational problem in the human existence. And so when we look at some of these and we look at what these ideals that Christ is going to start talking about, there was a commentator named F.B. Meyer who said this about the things that Christ writes in these next sections. He says, as manhood fulfills childhood, and the perfect or the final picture, the rude sketch, so does Jesus gather up, realize, and make possible the highest ideals ever inspired in human hearts or written by God's Spirit on the page of inspiration. So think about that. The things Christ is about to talk about are the highest ideals ever inspired in human hearts. Let that sit on that for just a second. Because then when you start reading through these, you'll realize what he's talking about. The things that Christ is telling his people to do are the highest ideals humanity has ever espoused. You can look at all sorts of ideologies and things that are in the world today. A big popular one today is humanism. And that sounds so great, doesn't it? Oh, humanism should care about all humans, except, you know, most of them believe in reproductive rights and abortion. So I guess those humans don't count, right? Environmentalism, everybody's heard that, right? Everybody's on environmentalism, and we've talked about how, you know, we are called to be stewards of what we have been given of God. We're not called to be just blatantly, oh yeah, pour all the oil in the rivers and kill all the fish and slaughter all, no, it doesn't matter, we're just going to eat, be merry and die, don't worry about it. No, we're, God gave us this earth, okay? He called us to be stewards of the earth. So, it's good for us to protect and to do things like that, to try to be good stewards of what He's given us. But, you know, it really does not account for human flourishing, and it doesn't account for humans sometimes. You know, because there's arguments that, hey, there's too many humans on the earth. They're the ones polluting the earth, so we should just start, you know, trimming back the fat a little bit. Okay? And then, of course, we talk about things like civil rights, which are absolutely essential and absolutely something that we as believers in Jesus Christ should espouse and should seek and should desire, because with civil rights, you have that inherent teaching that we have talked about, that every person deserves respect because they're made in the image of God. And so we talk about human rights and civil rights and things like that. But again, as you look at this, there is usually some people left out. Okay, so we're really, really strong about we need to make sure that this subset or this group of people have rights. Okay, but then again, you talk about unborn babies or you talk about elderly and euthanasia, and those rights just kind of, you know, they slip to the wayside. So there's all these ideals that are there, and some of them have really good principles within them. Okay, and some of them have really good teachings, and they're things that we can all get around and say, yes, but it's only in the teachings of Jesus Christ that you see the highest fulfilled potential in all this, where all people groups are included, all people, including unborn babies and elderly and everybody in between, all of them, it's seeking for their benefit, for their flourishing. So the teachings of Jesus Christ are the only ones that do that. And that's what sometimes you'll get in these debates or see people who are arguing about things on Facebook or Twitter or things like that, arguments about, you know, supporting people. It's like, yeah, and that's why we preach what we do. And that's why we as Christians, we should live what we preach, because it is the only teaching in the world, in existence, ever has been or ever will be, that says, yes, we do support life from everybody. So that's why it's important for us to talk about those things and realize that that is kind of what F.B. Meyer said was really true. Christ espoused the highest ideals that humanity has ever heard in this. And it was crazy to some of these people because they were like, oh, you know, I didn't know I was supposed to be doing all that. But what do you mean that if I'm... Even to these religious people, it was kind of out of the norm. And especially if you got outside the religious people and got to pagan, you know, cultures and things, of course this would be crazy talk. It's crazy talk today. Yeah. In all of our enlightened super smartness. If you look at different religious ideologies, the same thing applies. When you look at things like Buddhism, and you look at the teachings of it, people will get all behind, especially kind of, you know, more humanistic people will get behind Buddhism. Why? Because, well, there's not really one God you got to bow down to. It's very self-centered, okay? But it has really good humanistic ideals, like, you know, it's all pacifism. It's all about, really, you shouldn't kill anything, not even a cockroach, because you're reborn over and over and over again until you reach enlightenment, and you need to be doing good works while you're being born again into whatever you are, because that's the only way you break the cycle and get to enlightenment. So your whole purpose for doing anything is so that you can get to enlightenment and quit being born again as a cockroach. Well, that doesn't necessarily encourage human flourishing, okay? Because it's very self-centered. Hinduism is very much the same way. Islam has a lot of very good tenets in their principles. They have things like the zakat, which is that you're supposed to give a portion of your money, basically like a tithe, to support the poor. And people would say, well, that's a great, you know, a great idea. Of course, the whole reason that you keep all those is because if you don't keep them, then you might fall off that little narrow path to hell. And so, again, the whole reason for doing it is self-serving. Don't really care about the poor. You're not really caring about doing good. You're not really caring about any of that. It's just, I've got to make sure I do all this, because ultimately, if I don't, I'm never going to make it to paradise. Or you get the opposite of that. The one-way express ticket to paradise is actually blowing up and killing a bunch of people. Well, again, that's not very flourishing for humankind, is it? Of course, that is a more extreme kind of point of view of it, but you still have, there's still a self-centered, means-to-the-end kind of approach. Judaism is where we're circling back to, because in this time, that's what was happening with the Jews. The Jews he was talking to here were saying the exact same thing. Check the boxes off. Narrow it down. Thou shalt not murder. Okay, I have not physically gone and strangled anybody, therefore I'm good. Check. Now move on. I don't care about anything beyond that. I just have not done that. Therefore, I am fulfilling the law. But you can see there's a lot of gray area in that, isn't there? Without a fully filled out law, there's a lot of gray area in that. Well, what if I have someone else kill somebody? Am I guilty of the law then? I didn't actually do it. I'm clear. That's on that person. So they're the ones guilty of the law. I'm clear. Okay. What if I beat someone almost to death, but they still survived? Am I still guilty of thou shalt not kill? Well, I haven't actually killed them. I beat them to the point of death. But they didn't die. Therefore, I didn't kill them. Therefore, I'm not guilty of the law. So you can get away with all sorts of wicked, debaucherous, evil things against human people. And not be worthy of the law that said, thou shalt not kill. You haven't transgressed it. So they narrowed it down so much to give specific times and places and ways so that you had a way of passing off without actually being guilty of anything. So that's a really good, sweet thing to be in, right? You know, honor thy mother and father. Oh, except if you want to say it's a gift and you want to say that you're really doing this, well, then that's fine. Go ahead. So I've still kept the law, hadn't transgressed it, just hadn't done anything that God actually told me to do. So we see with what Jesus is talking about here, he's giving the highest watermark of these ideals. No, this is what it means to be a follower of me, and this is what all the kind of building out of it looks like. Okay, what not killing someone is going to look like? What not committing adultery is going to look like? Okay? And he actually starts getting back to what is the heart and the root of the issue, which is this thing within us that's doing this. So when we look at anger here in verses 20 through 26, number one, we see that phrase there, or that verse there, where he talks about, except your righteousness exceed that of the Pharisees. And I've heard a lot of people talk about this before. This is basically what that is saying. Number one, we always have gone back and talked about the kingdom of God is here. Okay, 99% of the time, the kingdom of God is here. It's here. This is where we're living. This is what we're doing. So when he's talking about entering into the kingdom of God, he's not talking about entering into heaven that you died and went to heaven and got saved. He's talking about entering into the kingdom here, just like he tells the rich young ruler, it's hard for rich people to enter in here to the kingdom here because they are too obsessed with riches. And so they want to serve whatever that means, which means backstabbing, corruption, seeking, working all the time. And you don't really have time for spiritual things of the kingdom of God. So here he's saying your righteousness need to exceed that of the Pharisees or you're not going to enter into the kingdom. Okay, and what he's saying is that the Pharisees aren't really righteous, okay? They're not really being righteous. They're keeping this law as a narrowed down, I did X, Y, Z, and I washed my hands, therefore I should deserve the kingdom. And he says, you got to do better than that. Okay, he said, what truly the righteousness you need to be doing is the righteousness that God and Christ is about to talk about here. And so that's what this exceeding the righteousness of the Pharisees, they were hypocrites. They weren't really being righteous, okay? But they thought they were because they were doing this law and they were washing the outsides of cups and all these things. And God's like, no, it's about mercy. It's about love. It's about compassion. That's what it's about, okay? So that's what, when he's saying you need to exceed, it means you actually need to do the things that I'm commanding you to do because otherwise you'll never enter into this kingdom. So here in verse 21 through 26, he talks about with the anger. And if we looked at this from the, which it comes from the Talmud, I think is where this was coming from. But let me read you what this said about talking about thou shalt not murder. Everyone that kills his neighbor with his hand, as if he strikes him with a sword or with a stone that kills him or strangles him till he dies or burns him in fire, seeing he kills him in any manner in his own person, lo, such an one must be put to death by the house of judgment or the Sanhedrin. Okay, so catch that, by the house of judgment. That's again where you talk about the person being subject to judgment. That's what we're getting back to. And the second part of it is if a man hires a murderer to kill his neighbor, or sends his servants and they kill him, or binds him and leaves him before a lion or the like, and the beast kills him, every one of these is a shedder of blood, and the sin of slaughter is in his hand, and he is guilty of death by the hand of heaven, for example, God, but he is not to be put to death by the house of judgment or the Sanhedrin. So you have this kind of, oh, so we got some gray areas. So, well, we can't put you to death for that, but you're guilty before God, and God will do it. But you see this kind of house of judgment, the subject to judgment, who is and who is not subject to judgment. Okay, so you start seeing already some fine lines of here, like, well, was it, was it not? I'm not sure. Well, we'll leave that up to God. Don't worry about it. Keep on going, you know. So there's a little bit of gray area here. So when he says here that if you were angry with your brother against cause, you got three separate things here that he's talking about. Three what is kind of levels of guilt almost. Okay, the first one is if you are angry with your brother without cause. Okay, and so we stop and we talk about what is angry with a cause. Okay, so angry with a cause is not like, oh, I have a legitimate cause. He ran me off the road, or I have a legitimate cause. They stole from me, or they called me an ugly name, or whatever it may be. No, anger with a legitimate cause, the only legitimate cause for anger is righteous indignation. Okay, so that's the only time that we can be angry about a situation and it be okay, right? And that is in a righteous manner. Do I have righteous anger? Am I angry about our nation's continued lawful destruction of babies? Yes. Okay, and that is righteous anger. Do I go blow up an abortion clinic and that be justified? No. That would be unrighteous actions, okay? But I can be angry about the situation. I can be angry about things that offends my God. I can be angry about things that are, you know, I can be angry if my children are going down a path or following things that I know is going to end in their ultimate death. I can be angry when they do that. So that's righteous anger, okay? Righteous anger is okay. Christ was angry with the money changers in the temple and he whipped them. Okay? Righteous anger. He was not guilty of this. Okay? He didn't come back and be like, oops, I slipped up. Sorry. You know, let me run down to the temple and make a sacrifice. No, he had righteous anger. He had all authority in his righteous indignation to brand a whip and go chasing some people out of his temple. Okay? That's righteous anger. So there's angry with your brother, and we need to note too that brother there is not talking about just your natural brother who came out of the same mom from you. It's not talking about your spiritual brother. It's talking about brotherhood, all of humans, okay? So he said it's not okay with you to be angry with anybody. So this is the situation you come to where, you know, people would start narrowing it down. Oh, okay, so my natural brother. Well, good. Well, I love him. It's been good. Or maybe I'm an only child. Now I'm not guilty of this ever, okay? Or even if you say spiritual brother, well, I got a small spiritual family. Then if I don't get outside of that, you know, I'm good. So I can run people off the road. I can cuss them out. I can do all sorts of stuff to them. And that'd be okay. That kind of anger would be okay. No, this is everybody. So the brother is brotherhood. It's brother out as of all coming from the same source. As in, we are all born of women because we are humans, okay? So he says you cannot be angry with anyone. Unjust causes anger. And I don't want to sound too much like Yoda, but you know, Yoda did say that fear creates anger, anger creates hate, hate creates suffering. I thought that was a pretty good thing, right? Nobody here watched Star Wars, do they? Nobody here just wants to admit and love the fact that I just quoted Yoda from the stand. I think that's really what more is coming down to it. But that is a very true statement, okay? Maybe not the fear so much part, but I guess you could work that in. But that anger will lead to other things, okay? Unjust anger will lead to bitterness. It will lead to hatred. It will lead to despitefulness. And it can lead to abuse. It can lead to suffering. It can lead to murder, okay? Cain was angry with Abel, and that escalated real quick, okay? And really, you got to go, man, Cain, I know it's speculation, but there's only four of you mentioned at this point. There's four humans in existence, and you just knocked one off. All right? That's pretty hardcore, okay? So anger leads to things. Anger leads to abuse. Anger leads to suffering. So that's why he says it is not okay to be angry with your brother. It's not just that you hadn't killed him yet. It's that being angry with him is an offense, and that you're subject to judgment for that. And again, he's using that word judgment, kind of like what the Jews were using it with the judgment house and with the Sanhedrin there. And he says, whosoever says to his brother, Rakah. Now, again, I know, just because I feel like all of y'all are just like me, okay? I know that you have read these verses of Scripture before and go, what in the world is he talking about? Okay? What is the deal with Rakah? Why is that such a big deal? Why is that a word, okay? Or that you've seen, oh, I called somebody a fool one time. I called my brother a fool. Oh, no, now I'm going to hell, okay? So I know you have looked through these before and gone, this is a very weird passage of Scripture. So when you look at the word Rakah, the word literally means someone deserving to be spit upon, okay? And it denotes a worthlessness or a witlessness, okay? Or someone who is a fool. Okay, you're spitting on them, making fun of them because they're ignorant. But mainly it's that you don't see worth in this person. They are worthless in your eyes. So when he's talking about this, he's saying it's not just a light thing of you use some weird Hebrew word on this person and now you're guilty of judgment and the council. And no, it's that you are basically saying to this person, you are worthless. Okay. And the reason that that's a problem is because, again, if we're building off of this, we start with anger, okay? And we talked about, you know, anger can lead to bitterness. It can lead to despitefulness. It can lead to hatred. When you start hating people, when you start hating a people group, okay, then you start looking at them as worthless, okay? They're not deserving of your attention, not deserving of your time, not deserving of your care. And so you start backing further and further away. So now that they are worthless, then things can happen to them that will not trouble my conscience at all. Okay? So I use the example a lot of times with Nazi Germany. You look at the progression, or I say, should say the degression, regression, ungression of that situation. And you have it where it started off, I'm angry with the Jews. Okay? And you have the famous, or infamous, I guess you should say, night of the Kristallnacht or whatever, the night of a thousand glass, broken glass and all that, that it was a reaction, an anger that the Germans had towards the Jews. Why? What had they done? Okay? What had they actually done to the German people? Nothing, okay? They didn't rise up against them. They didn't, you know, nothing. But they had an implanted anger based on rhetoric and everything that had gone on. So they developed an anger towards these people. So they go busting in glasses and saying, you people all need to be rounded up, okay? They started blaming them for all the problems in their country, all the poverty, all the recession, all these issues. It all gets back to, it's just all the Jews. I am so angry with the Jews that they did this to us. I hate the Jews because they did this to us. Now, I don't even care what happens to the Jews. And then 6 million are exterminated. It's a progression. You start with anger. It goes to bitterness, wrath, and hatefulness. It goes to worthlessness, Rakah. It goes to, you are worthless to me. I will spit on you, literally, okay? And then it goes into the last one, which is basically I'm just done with you. I care nothing about you. You are nothing more than, in some cases, less than an animal. This wasn't just in Nazi Germany, but it's the most close, it's the closest one to us, okay? But you have plenty of historical times where people groups themselves, this all happened to them. It starts off with anger, it starts off with bitterness, it starts off with hatred, it goes to worthlessness, and then you have genocide, okay? You can look at Rwanda, you can look at even the Jews in Egypt, okay? It started off, they were in kind of a good situation with Joseph, and then you get a few more generations down the road, and all of a sudden, these people were worthless, they were less than human, and it was an order or a law that you could go out and you could just drown them in the Nile if you wanted to. So you just see this dehumanization of people because of anger, all right? So Rakah, that was that slander of, or the degrading of, what we've talked about before being the Imago Dei, the image of God in man. That God said, this is why in the Old Testament he said, if you kill somebody, you are deserving of capital punishment. And it was because you have destroyed the image of God. Okay? And he didn't just say that about children of God. He said that for everyone. The law of Israel was, if you kill another person, you must be put to death. Because you are destroying the image of God. Because man was made in my image. That's what he said. So that's what this degradation, this Rakah that he's talking about. You're basically saying that this person is worthless. Well, this person was made in the image of God. So inherently they have worth. All right? That's what we talk about with life and with abortion and everything, is that no, every life has worth, no matter who it is, whether they're an infant, whether they're black, white, Hispanic, whether they are 99 years old, every life has inherent worth just because they were made in the image of God. Okay? And so this rakah is what affronts that. And so that's why he says that you will be subject to the council for this. And lastly, he talks about the fool. And again, people, I've heard all sorts of things, and people will take this so very literally, and they'll be like, no, you can't even say the word, okay? You can't even call someone a fool ever, because if you do, then you're in subject of hellfire. And they get very worried about this. And what this word technically does mean, fool, foolish, okay? It's the Hebrew word, the Greek word, I think is actually what it was morose, okay? Well, guess what that sounds like? Moron, all right? And that's what we call people. You moron, you know, you're acting like a moron. You're being a moron. And I think that if we were all going to hell because of that, there would be a lot of people in hell, okay? But what he says, and it does mean, it means heedless, it means stupid, it means dull, similar to what we would say with moron. But actually, when the Jews were using this as a slander to people, that's not what they were talking about. They weren't just saying you're being foolish, okay? Because again, I think with righteous anger, you can righteously angrily tell your child you're being foolish, okay? You are following a foolish path. In fact, like we said, Paul has even said before that when I was a child, I spake as a child, but when I was a grown up, I put away foolish things. And so he was telling these people to put away foolish things, which would obviously imply he was saying they were being foolish. So, you know, he's not going to hell because he said that. This is not talking about going to hell, except that when the Hebrews were calling people fools, when they were using this word, morose, or that, again, I think that's the Greek, actually, the Septuagint version of that. But when they were using this Hebrew word, they were wishing upon people hell. Okay? So it wasn't just they were calling them simpletons. They weren't saying you were dull, you're ignorant. They were actually so mad at this person that they were calling them a wicked, ungodly, graceless creature whose portion will be eternal damnation. That was what they were saying to this person. They had gotten so mad at this person that they were basically saying, I wish you'd go to hell. Well, obviously, then that takes a little bit more of a meaning when he says that these people who say that will be subject to hellfire. Okay? Takes a little bit more impact. Well, why, God, would you put such a... I mean, you didn't even do that when you're talking about murder up here. And you're saying if you wish someone... Why would you call it just for a foolish? No, it's because they were saying, we wish you would burn in hell. Well, now that makes a little bit more sense, doesn't it? Now that carries a little bit of weight of it about the wicked, angry, spiteful heart that would look at someone and wish that upon them. So that's just a whole different level of anger that breeds bitterness and hatred. And now you've gotten to the point that you wished someone to go to hell. And that's pretty harsh. The Hebrews, when they were talking about this, the reason that it talks about that hell fire, you could say fires of hell, in the Hebrew kind of tradition about this, is that the judgment for such was that whoever wished that upon their neighbor or whoever it was, they were then going to be reciprocated in the like manner. Okay? So if you wish this upon somebody, it was a judgment on you that you will receive exactly what you wished on them. So that's why he says you're in danger of hellfire, because the judgment of the Jews back then was, if you wish this on somebody, it will happen to you. Okay? So he was giving them that warning. But that, so he's using these Jewish traditions and historical applications in reference to the law, saying, see, you have been, you know, you had some of these that you were already doing, but you see, this is what the fulfillment of this law meant. It's not just that you didn't physically go and beat someone to death. It's that actually your anger is where all of this starts. And these are the levels that it can get to. And these are the consequences of that. And so then he closes with saying, what is the solution? What is the solution to this? Number one, the solution is that we walk in the Spirit of God, which gives us love. Okay? We are called and commanded to love, not to get angry and hate. We are called to love people, love our neighbors, and love our enemies. I'll just go ahead and tell you, if you want to try to be like the rich young ruler or the neighbor or anybody like that and try to figure out who that applies to, when you say your neighbors and your enemies, you have pretty much encompassed the entire world, okay? So you've pretty much, if you can't get it all with your neighbors, you can get it with your enemies, okay? If there's people who you want to try to slide into that group and try to, or slide out of that group, well, enemies captures all the other ones. So you're loving people who maybe are lovable, or at least in proximity to you that you could love, and then you're loving people who just are in proximity to you and hate you, or hate you from a distance, whatever it may be. But he says you are to love your neighbors and love your enemies. So the first solution to that is love. We are not given this spirit of anger and malice and hate and things. In fact, if you go look at the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5, that God says this is what comes with the Spirit. Right above that, he talks about all those things. He says this is the works of the flesh: hate, malice, deceitfulness, wickedness. And then he goes, but this is the Spirit, and this is what you have been given. So born again children of God have love, not anger and hate. And the second thing that he goes into here is he says, if you do have odds with someone, before it ever gets started, before it ever gets rolling down that hill, before that snowball picks up speed and you can't get it to stop, he says, before you get to that part where you let your anger start taking over and dominating and growing into some of these other more vicious things, he says, you go and you get reconciliation. Reconciliation is basically a change. It's a change of mind. It's a change of interaction. And what you're saying by reconciliation is that y'all have this issue with one another, that your minds are a certain way about each other over whatever the offense is. And he says, go get reconciliation. Change that. Flip it. Turn it around. In 2 Corinthians, Paul will say that, you know, we have been given the ministry of reconciliation. Okay, that we have a ministry of testifying, living, and preaching, and acting, and witnessing in ways of the reconciling work of Jesus Christ. Okay, well, you can't do that if you can't even reconcile with your neighbor over a problem. So if people can't see the reconciling work of Jesus Christ working out in your day-to-day interactions, they definitely aren't going to see anything else. So reconciliation is what he calls for. So we start with love, compassion, mercy, long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, goodness, temperance. And if we do get into a situation where we have aught against our brother or problems with our neighbor or issues with our people that we come in contact with, he says you should seek it, and seek it first, and seek it quickly to reconcile and not let it linger. So I hope these things have been beneficial. Again, we're going to try to go into lust next time. So, yay, everybody's excited. So we'll hopefully get into that. But Lord willing, continue to pray, and hopefully you'll continue to read and search and look into these things as we go on.